As entrepreneurs, we see the world differently. In a world that not only tolerates but promotes mediocrity, we unreasonably demand more. Giving you access to the world's most successful entrepreneurs and thought leaders, this podcast uncovers the untold truths of what it really takes to build a multi-million dollar business while optimizing your personal performance in every area of your life. I'm Jack DeLosa. Let's get to work. Welcome to another episode of the Jack DeLosa podcast, the place you go to master your business and elevate your life. I am super excited about today's episode because I am joined by a great Australian legend, and I do not use that word lightly. The great man to my left needs no introduction, Michael Klim, Australian swimmer, Olympic gold medalist, former world record holder, 6 Olympic medals, including 2 golds, and 11 Commonwealth medals. Just before we started the shoot, I asked Michael, how many Commonwealth medals have you won, mate? He couldn't work it out. He couldn't remember. So our COO behind the cameras recently Googled it, told us, we can confirm. It's 11. Definitely 11.
Mate, it's 20 years ago. I can't remember what I did last week.
Well, you know you're doing something well when you can't remember how many Commonwealth medals you've won.
Yeah, I guess so. And it's obviously, you know, I try and live in the moment. You know, you're only as good as your last race.
Let's go back to the beginning because, you know, one of the things I really want to explore in this episode, you know, having spent a bit of time with you and trained with you and really gotten to know you a little bit, it's really evident to me that there's a lot of practices and strategies that you've employed, not only to become a gold medalist and, you know, an Australian hero, but also launch your own business in Klim, Milk by Michael Klim. And so I want to talk about some of the rituals, practices and strategies and how the viewers and listeners can translate that to any area to have success in life and business. Yeah. So take us back to before you had made it. What did your daily routine look like? How many hours were you in the pool?
Look, I mean, I might take you back even before that, because before I, you know, before I found out that I actually had a little talent in swimming, I mean, the way I ended up in swimming was probably quite interesting. Most people don't realize that I actually grew up in India, and I spent 5 years in India. My dad was the trade attaché for the Polish consulate, and I was very transient, moved from Poland to India to Germany and Canada, but I learned to swim in a country that's renowned for their spin bowlers, not really for this. For the swimmers, I should say. So, you know, I developed this skill. I found this skill very early on in my life, and that became the thing that remained constant through every change that I've had after that point. So, I learned to swim probably about the same time I learned to walk, and pretty much we changed languages, countries, schools, and the thing that always I gravitate to was my swimming. So. I arrived in Australia in 1989 and I was 11. The first place I went to was a swimming club, the Melbourne Vixena Swimming Club on Batman Avenue. Doesn't longer exist. Actually, it sank the pool, which is pretty sad. It's Federation Square now. But so I was very lucky and fortunate that I found my passion at the age of 2. You know, like this skill that has stuck with me is given me so much, you know, opportunity and meet great people, etc., travel. But so that's, I guess, that was the thing that the catalyst for everything, you know. And so for me, my routine when I first started going to university, high school in Coburg, I used to get up at about 4:30, 4:40 in the morning. I used to wake up my parents if they hadn't got up and woken me up, and I'd prefer my bags the night before and make sure I had 2 bags, one bag of food and one bag of swimming. Oh, actually 3, one bag of food, one bag of school gear. I forgot about the school stuff and one bag of swimming gear. So
it was the least important bag out of the 3.
But I used to drive up. We used to live in Moorabbin, which is about 20 minutes from the city in Melbourne. I trained from 5:30 to 7:30, go up to Coburg to school, to uni high, come back, train in the afternoon. Go home, back to Moorabbin, and fall asleep on my desk doing my homework. So I used to swim probably 8 to 9 times a week when I was probably between the age of 12 to 14, 15. And at the age of 16, I got tapped on the shoulder by a couple scouts and great coaches and decided to move to Canberra. And that's kind of where my official swimming career kind of began.
It's interesting you mentioned, you know, you're fortunate enough to have a bit of skill and talent in the early years. One of my views is that talent alone simply isn't enough. If it's not rounded out and built upon with an incredibly hard work ethic, then it's not going to take you far. What's your view on that?
Oh, absolutely. And if that's the, you know, you look at elite swimmers or elite athletes or people in the elite field. I mean, there are so many people that are talented, so many people that have the same gift physically, mentally. But it's probably, you know, for me, it was the drive. I had this drive and people go, how did you find this drive? And it's kind of innate. I don't know where it came from. I don't know. And it certainly wasn't my parents pushing me. It was maybe the values that they set in me when I was a kid. I knew that they sacrificed a lot for us to, you know, give us a great future and, you know, opportunities. Maybe there was something that they instilled in me that I felt responsible to repay them.
Yeah.
But, and look, to be honest, it was, as a kid, I wanted, you know, you want recognition from your peers and it's something, swimming, I always was able to stand out in front of in front of all my mates and I became, you know, well known for that at a very early age already. So, definitely, I think you need to, there's so many people that have great talents, but what you do with that and how you pursue it is different.
So the scouts came along at the age of 18. I imagine the routine would have sort of ramped up after that, particularly heading into your Olympic career. What did your routine start to look like when you were at the peak of your career?
Yeah, so basically, you know, I moved from Melbourne to Canberra, lived at the Institute of Sport. So I hadn't finished year 12 yet. So I had to complete year 12 by correspondence. And so I basically, my whole life revolved around performance and performing the highest level I could in swimming. So we would be way up the swimming hours up to, you know, we'd be training 10 times a week in the pool, 3 or 4 times in the gym. We'd do a bunch of dry land training as well. But everything revolved about performance and performing once or twice or 3 times a year max.
How many hours would that have been?
I think close to 30 hours of physical training a week, probably.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so probably as much time as most people spend in the office.
Work, right, yeah.
But it was almost like a job. But we had so many, you know, like everyone was there to help us. So we had great, obvious physiologists, biomechanists. We had, you know, doctors, masseuses, everyone. So we had so many great resources. It was quite interesting because it took me about nearly 2 years, 3 years to work out how to use those resources. There are so many great tools that we have in life now with apps and self-help and everything that a lot of people don't know how to use them. So it took me a while to realize how to use those resources properly.
Mate, have you ever thought about cumulatively how many kilometers you've swam?
So on average, I'd probably swim 50 k's a week. So it was, what's that, over 10,000 k's a year?
You know, 18 years?
Yeah, well, longer, you know. Probably close to, 25 years or so, I reckon.
So was that 10,000 or 50,000 a year?
10,000.
10,000 a year over 25, so about 250,000 kilometres. Right. How far would that, how many times does that get you around the globe? Once. Our COO is Googling it, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be back with more information in a minute.
Yeah. So, and on average, there's about 3,000 rotations of your shoulder a session. So,
right.
It's not a surprise that you get a bit of RSI or tendonitis.
Yep. Let's talk about performing on a world stage under, you know, such a high pressure environment. What did you do to calm yourself and to ensure that you're at your best when the lights were on, the cameras were on, and the world was watching?
For me, it came down to just having clarity. So the moment where you hear more things, you notice more things, I think that's when doubt is creeping in. So I had this event. I was ranked number one in the world in 96. I went to Atlanta. Everyone was expecting me to win. I was 18. I missed the final by 6/100ths of a second, and that was the defining moment that my whole swimming career changed. So up to that point, I wanted to swim like my training mate Alexander Popov. He was renowned for this beautiful economic style. He was 6'8". He was called the Tsar of Sprint, but sadly, I'm not 6'8", and I didn't have his physical attributes. And So I had to evolve. So I had this really big disappointment. I came home crying and I said, I never wanted to feel that nervous standing on the blocks again. So I embarked on this whole new campaign where I evolved everything from my technique, the technology of the suits I was working with, my training methods. So it was basically, yeah, so that was a defining moment. So for me, that was, I forgot the question actually, but.
You were touching on it. You were particularly nervous in that instance. You said you'd never want to be that nervous again. The question was around how do you manage your nerves when the cameras are on?
So I did all that. And then the final straw was really to make that process of racing and when automatic. So I didn't have to put too much thought into actually racing. Right. When the gun goes, it was just like basically it was already in me. I've practiced it a billion times. I did 150 races in one calendar year. So almost the same process of getting ready for a race, standing up on the blocks, the gun going. It was almost like I was a greyhound with a rabbit going past me. So you almost want to make it really that simplistic.
What would you be thinking in the lead up to a race as you're waiting to be called up and walking up to the blocks?
We normally have three or four different cues that we focus on in the race. So for me, it was breath hold for the first sort of 15 to 20 meters. Then you work on rhythm, accelerating into the wall, really breaking it down into smaller chunks. Because it happens so quickly, you can't really focus stroke per stroke. Some swimmers can over longer distances, but in a 48-second race, when you're spending 30 meters of that underwater, and it's super quick, super explosive, you have to really, you know, identify three or four different cues that you can focus on.
One of your key principles, which I love, is a huge element of high performance is self-care. Mm. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, I think I've only really identify that in retrospect that I think as athletes, you know, we spend so much, swimming is a very meditative practice. And you know, I didn't realize how much it was until I stopped. You know, we're obviously swimming in, you know, obviously non-land-bearing sort of environment. And water is a beautiful medium. We can't hear anything properly, can't see properly either. So it's we're spending probably 4 hours a day meditating, you know. And I only realized how much I missed it when I sort of stopped that structure and the routine of that. But when we were sort of obviously getting ready for peak performance in the pool, you'd make sure recovery was done, we'd have our ice bath, we'd eat well. But now simplifying all that, so I'll try to take out the four things that are really worked well for me in my sporting career was one, sleep. I mean, you can't perform at the highest level without the rest. Nutrition, and that comes down to making sure you eat, you know, correctly, if you need supplements, etc. Exercise, doing the right training, if it's whatever exercise you may need. And then the third one is mindfulness. So just mindfulness back then was probably, you know, having the right mindset, having the right routine. Now it's a little bit different, but I think those four things I've been able to take away to self-care.
But let's just touch on that, because another thing you talk about is lifestyle by design in every area of your life, and you sort of boil down that to the four areas that you just mentioned. So let's start with exercise. What are some of your strategies that you employ, you encourage other people to employ to ensure that they're exercising, not only in a way that's right for them, but in a way that's consistent?
Yeah. I spoke at something recently, and I believe movement is medicine, and it's you know, it's the more motion is lotion. I've heard all these things say before. So the more, if you sit still for long, like you're going to, you know, you get stiff, right? Yeah. So you're going to keep moving. So I just, so I encourage people to move every day. Like if it's going for a walk, or going for a swim, you know, I have structured exercise and I have incidental exercise where I have to chase my kids around the house or whatever, or going for a surf with them. That's incidental. It's fun. But then like this morning when you push yourself a little bit harder where we're training, that's structured, but you need to push yourself. That's when the physiological change happens, the mental change happens. So, for me, it's if I take out exercise, I guarantee everyone will say they hate the personality that comes out. So it's a big part of my life to this day.
Let's talk about sleep.
Yeah.
How do you ensure that you're maximizing and getting enough sleep?
I'm very fortunate that I can sleep pretty much anywhere.
Yeah.
On planes, and I could sleep right here.
Was that also the case the night before a big, you know, like Olympic level race?
Pretty much. I think, wow. You know, I was, sometimes your mind races, you replay the race and your mind, and you've got those cues that are going over and over in your head. But it's, you know, when you're prepared well, you know, you've got less chatter in your head, right. You know, and it's, but you know, we did everything, we tried to do things to maximize, you get good sleep. So exercise helps you, getting outdoors helps you, having routine helps you. So, you know, I think we were pretty well rehearsed in that process.
Diet, there's a lot of discussion around keto diets, intermittent fasting.
Yeah.
What sort of diet do you subscribe to and, you know, most of the time suggest to other people?
Just eat clean, really. Yeah. I don't really have too much. I've dabbled in different diets here and there, but I think even when we're performing at the highest level in the pool, it's all about balance and listening to your body too. Like I look at my son Rocco, he'll come home from school and he'll like, you know, down 2 yogurts in 5 seconds. You know, his body's obviously craving calcium, he's growing. Yeah. You know, so sometimes, you know, we're smarter than what we give ourselves credit for. So if you've got a craving, maybe not, you know, a bag of lollies, but if you've got a craving, obviously there's, you have to listen to some of those cravings, and that's what I try and do.
Mindfulness was the fourth area, and you do a lot of speaking on this, you host camps on this. It's one of the reasons I think we've connected so well. Talk to us about some of the different elements of mindfulness that you advocate for.
Well, for me, it's funny because obviously we spoke about the mindfulness wasn't really a practice that I actively was involved in when I was swimming. And it's only really adopted in the last few years and probably through some personal, you know, things that happened in my life. And I felt that I needed to really take care of myself mentally. And mental health became probably something that I was, you know, avoiding for a long time, and I identified that I really needed to explore it further. And because I was getting those moments of quietness and I was getting those moments to myself previously, running a business, having 3 kids, and it's constantly on the go, I needed to find that time of quiet. And it doesn't take very long. So I do a lot of, mainly through breath work. I do some guided meditation, but it doesn't take very long. Yeah.
Let's switch gears and talk about Milk by Michael Klim. Talk to us about that journey and where the business has come to where it's at today.
Yeah, I landed in it quite quite accidentally, I think. I was approached by a couple of brands to be kind of their ambassador or spokesperson, and I thought, oh, how come these guys have come to me within such a short period? And obviously, being an athlete, being quite vain, and swimming outdoors and smelling like chlorine, we've always used products from a very early age. So I had this kind of incidental insight into products. Looking after my skin was quite pretty normal. We used to hand around products in the shower and say, oh, let's try this, it smells good, whatever. So it wasn't foreign for me. And I think there was definitely, you know, and then I asked around and I did a little bit of research, and there was definitely an opportunity in the market. The men's skincare market back in 2006 was growing at a crazy 48%, which is phenomenal. Mm. Like, it's plateaued out almost to single figures now. But so there was nothing made for Aussie blokes, Australian made, created by another guy. So there was the opportunity. So my sporting family experience, I try to bottle it, and here we are. So I started having kids. There was obviously, there's nothing good enough for your kids out there, right? So
yeah.
I created an offer that, you know, that was all natural, organic, Australian made again. So the baby range came around.
Yeah.
And then we evolved into, probably from demand from the market, into a women's offer as well.
Yeah, right. Now, you've just come back from Noosa, where you were sponsoring a major event up there. What's your key role in the business today?
Look, I'm pretty much still very much hands-on, even though I reside in Bali most of the time. You know, pretty much it started from designing everything from the logo to the ingredients listing, but overseeing sales and marketing is kind of my role, what I enjoy. I still love the face-to-face, the door knocking and selling the product. I really take pride in selling it to people and telling about the offer and And look, the story is genuine. I've created the brand. It wasn't me putting my name onto something that someone else created. So the products that we add or we take away, it's all because, you know, there's a reason to it and we believe it's right and hopefully they agree. But so yeah, obviously, and we try and spread the message. So I, you know, it's all, you know, what it's like about with PR and publicity, making sure it's a very competitive space out there and everyone's now through Instagram and different platforms, you have to be seen and visibility is something that I try and promote.
Yeah, and achieve it well.
Exactly.
What were some of the habits and disciplines that you really ingrained in yourself in swimming that have translated and underpinned your success in business?
Good question. Look, I think I came into this in the skincare business having no idea about it at all. So I had no retail experience, never finished tertiary education. So I was very and very similar in that. In when I had that massive failure in '96, I started re-educating myself as an athlete. So constantly from 2008 up to this point, I'm always learning about not only about our brand, but about the market, about the industry, and the whole, you know, market space. So so I think that's been the constant evolution in knowledge has been really important for me. And, you know, I also evolved as an athlete, and I think as a brand, we continue to evolve as well. That's been really important. Things at the team, and I know you pride yourself on this a lot. And I think the people in your business make your business. And, you know, we've gone through transitions, and keeping the right team or the right culture can be tricky. And I think that's why the Aussie swim team was so successful, because we had the guys with all the same values. You know, we didn't have a team leader because everyone was kind of leading by example. So so they're the things that I sort of look at. Obviously, we spoke about evolution and that the sense of drive and passion, which I spoke about before, which I had, was innate. Try and recreate that. And why is it important to me? Is it I prioritize because I've got, you know, I've got a family. I want to, you know, it's also a sense of pride for them. Use them as guinea pigs back in the day. So it's better be successful. But those things. But for me, it was always about structure. And I think when I remove structure from anything that I do, I feel lost.
You mentioned values. One of the things we've spoken about previously is, you know, when you were feeling a bit down and out throughout the peak of your career, you'd actually go back to not only your personal values, but the team values and re-engage. Talk to us about that and how important values have been not only for you personally, but in amongst a team environment.
Yeah, so it's key. It's really, they come into play when you have a downtime. And it's, you know, in 2004 is a perfect example. 2003, I had two shoulder reconstructions. I was kind of down and out. I didn't think I was going to get back on the Aussie team. Give you an idea, I spent, I couldn't lift my shoulder above this high, which is not ideal for swimming. Right. So I spent probably, you know, nearly a year just kicking with a snorkel. So I would be up to 30, 40 kilometers a week just using my legs. And that, not to say, oh, my legs are going to get stronger, but just to be around the people that have, you know, about my fraternity and with the same values that it would support me through that time. So so the mentality was that really we're trying to focus on the things we can do rather than things we can't do, which people get so down and disappointed. And so that was, you know, and then, you know, for me, my teammates was important. About that, the fulfillment, the friendship, those sort of things were really, and some of them were unwritten, you know, but we knew they were so common in on the team.
Yeah.
And we only found that out, we did a kind of like a bit of a, you know, value kind of assessment, and there were similarities across the board.
Yeah, yeah. We've got some good questions that have come in from our Instagram audience. Thomas Popple says, what's the biggest mistake you've learned from?
Oh, I didn't understand my numbers early on in the business and made a lot of costly mistakes. Just kind of thinking, oh, yeah, it'll be okay. I'll leave it, it'll turn around. But I wish I acted on a lot of things or educated myself on that in that space earlier.
Right. Biggest mistake in sport?
Oh, I don't think I made mistakes. Probably, I think, you know, I don't have too many regrets. I overtrained. Probably that could be a regret. but that was, for me, that was a more of a psychological thing, standing on the blocks knowing that I've done more than the guy next to me. So it's a, I don't know if it's a mistake, depending on, yeah, it's very hard to, to answer that one.
John Paul Kelly, any tips on biohacking? This is a good question, because another sort of thing that you and I have in common is we love the hot, cold immersion stuff.
Yeah,
talk to us about your biohacking habits.
Look, I was introduced, Dean Gladstone introduced me to ice baths, and I do a lot of breath work and also to Wim Hof, sort of the breathing. And but to be honest, we were doing the submersion stuff a long time ago.
Yeah.
And it's the Institute had ice bath back in 93, 94. So it's an old practice that it's become really well known now and popular. And the benefits of it are, I mean, you know what, how great you feel afterwards. So for me, it's really, I probably have a real serious ice bath probably two or three times a week.
Yeah.
But I mean, at Bali, it's a lot harder. I need to get 25 ice bags to fill the big bath. But and you know, obviously, it's in Australia, it's much easier where you've got facilities for that.
How long would you stay in the ice bath for?
Oh, it depends. It's amazing how you can judge how you're feeling your body as well and how long you can actually last.
Yeah.
So between five to seven to sometimes 10 minutes.
Yep.
And then, reduce that.
Right.
Yeah.
Mate, on that, you've mentioned that a couple of times in terms of listening to your body. You mentioned it with diet and with training and now with ice bath. How do you discern, this might be a challenging question to answer, but how do you discern the difference? You know, you're sitting in an ice bath, it's incredibly uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
How do you discern between the point of, I want to get out just because it's uncomfortable, and I want to get out because I should, because my body's ready.
Yeah. But I don't think it's, you're not trying to prove anything. I don't try and prove anything to myself. I think the outcome I want is, the feeling you're going to get afterwards.
Yeah.
And as long as that cellular change is happening, then I'm pretty much happy. So, I don't really, a lot of the time I do it, in the privacy of my own home, so I'm not trying to show off. So it's as long as I feel that I've done enough, then I'm satisfied.
Justin Dry, who's the founder of Vino Mofo, $100 million wine business here in Australia, he asked, "How hard did you guys work out this morning?"
How hard was it? You tell me.
It was pretty hard, actually. It wasn't as difficult as I thought it was going to be, given I was training with Michael Klim, but I survived.
My warm-up was six times six chin-ups, so that's a pretty solid warm-up.
It was a solid workout.
All right. We're doing it again tomorrow,
we'll step it up again. With some hot and cold immersion tomorrow as well, so that'll be good. Let's do some rapid-fire questions to finish with. Popular piece of health advice that you do not agree with?
Health advice. I would say, I mean, we spoke about dieting. You know, people cut out so many different, and unless you have allergies, then and you're not allowed to eat those sort of foods. But some people cut out, major food groups out of their diet, which I don't. I think we've evolved as a species that we can tolerate, and we can, we've adapted. And so, I mean, everyone's different, but I don't know. It seems a bit, and it's the trends and fads that change, but we end up coming back to the similar
100%. Yeah.
Balance. Yeah.
What's a question you wish more people would ask you?
I don't know, actually. I've never thought about that. How many languages do I speak?
How many languages do
Three.
You speak? Right. What are they?
Polish. I speak Polish at home still.
Yeah.
English somewhat, and then a little bit of German.
English somewhat. Nice. That's awesome. What habit have you developed that's had the biggest impact on your life? It might be a mental habit or a...
I think perseverance. I think just, I've learned through... Even especially more in business, I was very fortunate that I didn't have too many disappointments in my career. But in business, it that relentless nature of it's good day, bad day, or within a day, actually, it's a roller coaster sometimes.
Yeah.
So I think that this habit of just being okay, just forgetting the last half an hour and just walking into a room with a completely fresh mindset.
Yeah, perseverance.
Yeah.
And to finish on, if we went back to the day 16 years of age, the scouts came in, said, yeah, we want to start work with you. We want to develop you. What's the number one piece of advice you'd give yourself then, knowing everything you know now?
Look, I think, I didn't start learning. I was probably a little bit too cocky as a kid. And, right. I thought, oh, yeah, these guys believe in me. Things will happen by themselves. And I think you almost need to make it happen yourself. So until I realized that I needed to make changes, and I couldn't put all my faith in these great coaches and these great, you're the master of your own destiny. So people talk about creating change. You have to do that yourself. So unfortunately, it took me bad disappointment I had in Atlanta to realize that. Mm. But I think the earlier people can, grab the reins, the better they're going to be.
Absolutely. Yeah. Personal responsibility.
Exactly.
Michael, for those that want to follow you, what's the best way to do that?
Michael Klim 1 or Klim by Michael Klim is our Klim page, and
on
also
Instagram,
Milk & Co.
Yep.
Yeah, on Instagram. Yep. Facebook is just Michael Klim.
Beautiful. Mate, you are an absolute legend. I really admire your humility.
Thanks, mate.
It has been an absolute honor to have the
discussion. Look forward to tomorrow morning.
Yes, back in the sauna.
I've got to train harder now.
Back in the cold plunge pool. Let's do it. See you next time, team.
See you, guys.
Thanks for tuning into today's podcast. I'm Jack DeLosa. If you enjoyed listening, make sure you hit subscribe and you'll be the first in line to get every new episode sent directly to your phone. While you're at it, open Instagram and connect with me. My handle is simply at Jack DeLosa, DELOSA. This is where you'll find me every day sharing the secrets of scaling multi-million dollar businesses and giving you a behind the scenes look at what it really takes to build a life that you love. You can also find me on all the usual places, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. Just search Jack DeLosa. Thanks again for listening. And as always, dream out loud. That's a wrap.